Meanwhile, here on FM, Julian Barrett continues our Book of the Week, A Broken Hallelujah by Liel Liebowitz. Leonard Cohen begins to find his place in the contemporary music scene, but struggles to take his spiritual vision to the audience. Extracts from his personal papers are read by Colin Stinton.
The stories of the street are mine. The Spanish voices laugh.
Leonard Cohen's decision to abandon his modestly successful career as a writer and a poet at the age of 32 in order to become a singer is so profoundly strange that attempts to explain it tend to be either banal or fantastic. But one likely story involves Bob Dylan.
Yes, one hand on my suicide, one hand on the road.
Sometime in 1965, Cohen discovered the young Jewish poet, nearly a decade his junior, and was immensely drawn to Dylan's cryptic, haunting lyrics. It's not hard to see what may have attracted Cohen to Dylan. Like Cohen, Dylan grew up in a family that was actively involved with its local Jewish community. Both men, when young, attended Zionist summer camps and were taken with the Jewish folk songs they learned there. But most important, Dylan was on fire. Listening to With God on Our Side or Masters of War, it was easy enough to imagine that if Isaiah had been born in the 1940s, he'd have found his way to the stage at the Gaslight Cafe to sing and preach. Listening to Dylan, Cohen heard the same language he'd heard years before when he studied the prophets as a child. Sometimes Dylan's lines came directly from the scriptures. By 1966, Leonard Cohen was heading in the same direction. He had played music before in a high school country and western band called the Buckskin Boys with friends in Montreal and for his partner, Marianne. But he was always more than a casual strummer. Everything he'd ever written, he later told an interviewer, the poems, the short stories, the novels, the songs, was just
one big diary set to guitar music.
Committed to his new career choice, Cohen left his Greek island retreat after 7 years there and moved to New York City. He rented an apartment downtown for Marianne and her son Axel. But he himself lived in a series of hotels, the last and best known of which was the Chelsea. Never feeling entirely at home, even when he was at home, he took comfort in hotel life.
You always have the feeling in a hotel room that you're on the lam, and that it's one of the safe moments in the escape. It's a breathing spot. The hotel room is the oasis of the downtown. It's a kind of refuge, a sanctuary of a temporary kind, and therefore all the more delicious. But whenever I come into a hotel room, there's a moment after the door is shut and the lights you haven't turned on illumine a very comfortable, anonymous, subtly hostile environment. And you know that you found a little place in the grass, and the hounds are going to go by for 3 more hours. You're going to have a drink, light a cigarette, and take a long time shaving.
But it was not an auspicious scene for a young poet with a guitar, hesitantly taking his first steps as a musician. The world Leonard Cohen had most likely imagined he would inhabit was fading, and a new one, white hot, was emerging.
Let me tell you how it will be. There's one for you, 19 for me. Cause I'm the tax man. Yeah, I'm the tax man.
Revolver, the Beatles' new UK release, came out in August 1966. From the very first track, Taxman, the album declared war on everything that had come before it. The song's lyrics, complaining about the steep taxes the band had to pay on its considerable earnings, are sharp and caustic. A far cry from the Love Me Do's of 1962. And the guitars are grating, the result of the recording tape having been fed into the recorder and played backwards, a new effect the Beatles discovered during the making of Revolver. And they used it giddily and often.
I'm the tax man. Yeah, I'm the tax
man. In other words, Revolver sounded like nothing else before it. 1966 was the year of transforming sound. The Rolling Stones introduced the sitar on Paint It Black, while the 13th Floor Elevators played the electric jug on their influential first album. New instruments and new recording techniques were all de rigueur, but new ideas were even more important. And by 1966, redemption of mind, of soul, of body was what rock and roll was after. This might have fitted nicely with the designs of a poet interested in prophecy, but the scene wasn't kind to Leonard Cohen. He visited agent after agent and was denied. He was too old, his songs too sad. Finally, through a friend, he was referred to a fellow Canadian named Mary Martin, who worked for Bob Dylan's manager. Martin made the necessary introductions, and by November of that year, two of Cohen's first compositions were recorded by Judy Collins on her breakthrough album, In My Life. One was called Dress Rehearsal Rag, the other was Suzanne, an early poem set to music. The album went gold almost immediately.
Suzanne takes you down to a place by the river. You can hear the boats go by. You can spend the night forever. And you know that she's half crazy. That's why you want to be there.
Still, he found New York inhospitable. The music was cool, but Cohen wasn't. He travelled back and forth between New York and Canada, spending months on each of his songs, getting into his lifelong habit of writing dozens of verses for each one, and then slowly trimming them down to their bare essence. He took part in the drug culture, but noted that it failed to do for him what it had done for John Lennon or Brian Wilson or Lou Reed. Frustrated, he wrote barbed bits of poetry.
I am so impatient I cannot even read slowly. I never really loved to learn. I want to live alone, in fellowship with men. I'm telling you this because secret agreements bring misfortune.
Eventually, Mary Martin called and asked him out to lunch. They'd be dining, she said, with John Hammond, the man who had discovered Billie Holiday and Aretha Franklin and, most important, just 6 years earlier, Bob Dylan. Hammond went to see Cohen at the Chelsea. He took him to a nearby restaurant and made sure to talk about everything but music. Then he looked at Leonard and said, "Let's go back to the hotel and maybe you'll play me some songs." Back in his room, Cohen played Suzanne, the Stranger song, Master song, and Hey, That's No Way to Say Goodbye. Hammond was immediately convinced. When Cohen put down his guitar, Hammond simply said, "You got it." Cohen wasn't sure if by it Hammond meant talent, a contract, or both. In August 1967, Cohen entered the studio to record his debut album with his assigned producer, a talented musician called John Simon. Simon believed that Cohen's songs needed sweetening. To save Suzanne from droning, Simon suggested drums. Cohen objected. Simon tried for a different sort of syncopation and brought in a piano player. Cohen insisted that the piano be removed. The song, he said, should be linear, should be smooth. The result of this collision course is haunting. Listening to the album, simply called Songs of Leonard Cohen, you can hear strings, cymbals, a whole menagerie of instruments, all playing softly, faintly in the background, lacerated by Cohen's guitar.
I loved you in the morning, our kisses deep and warm, your head on the pillow like a sleepy golden storm. It's many love before us, I know that we are not new.
The disjointed production, however, was plagued by much more than artistic differences or the jitters of a first-time singer. At its heart was a metaphysical problem. The problem of taking a spiritual vision and translating it into words and chords so that others listening would instantly understand its meaning. When the album came out, the New York Times entitled its review, "Alienated Young Man Creates Some Sad Music." Cohen, wrote the esteemed critic Donal Henahan, sounds like a sad man, cashing in on self-pity and adolescent loneliness. The reviews seem to have left Cohen in a somber state of mind.
Around 30 or 35 is the traditional age for the suicide of the poet. That's the age when you finally understand that the universe does not succumb to your command.
The universe abided, leaving Cohen at 34 with a small coterie of devoted fans and modest commercial success, but no cataclysmic sense of transformation. But he was a singer now. His second album, Songs from a Room, recorded in Nashville and released in 1969, was even starker than Songs of Leonard Cohen had been. His new producer, Bob Johnston, believed that the best approach to cultivating sound was to intervene as little as possible. This chimed with Cohen, who wanted nothing standing between his listeners and his words. In Bird on the Wire, for example, there's a verse that describes in plain language two different encounters.
I saw a beggar leaning on his wooden crutch. He said to me, "You must not ask for so much." And a pretty woman leaning in her darkened door. She cried to me, "Hey, why not ask for more?"
They're delivered in the first person, making them feel intimate, as if Cohen was merely recalling something that had happened to him the other day. But of course, there's much more to the song than that. It has a little bit of the prayer.
I swear by this song, and by all that I have done wrong, I will make it all up to thee.
And a little bit of the anthem.
I have tried, in my way, to be free.
But it is neither. It is first and foremost a confession of imperfections, Cohen's own, and then an exhortation never to lose sight of the beacons of beauty that break through even the thickest darkness.
Like a drunk in a midnight choir, I have tried in my way to be free.
Cohen's candor proved appealing. Songs from a Room did better than its predecessor, making his name in Europe while selling modestly in the United States. And with Cohen's renown far greater in Europe than it was stateside, Columbia Records urged him to go on tour for the first time, which struck him as a bad idea.
The risks of humiliation were too wide.
Cohen had suffered from depression his entire life. His recent breakup with Marianne did little to improve his mood. He loved writing songs, but hated singing them in front of people, especially hordes of people he didn't know. It felt dishonest to him, and it made his grim state of mind worse. But the label insisted, and in 1970, armed with a band of musicians and a copious amount of hallucinogens, he set off on tour, expecting the worst.
Julian Barrett was reading A Broken Hallelujah by Leal Liebowitz, with Colin Stinton as the voice of Leonard Cohen. The producer was Pippa Vaughan, and it was a Loftus production for BBC Radio 4. From Cell Block H through Bad Girls to Orange is the New Black, Jenny Murray discusses the role of women in prison dramas after the news. But first, here's James Naughtie.
On Book Club this month, we're talking to Emma Donoghue, author of the Man Booker-nominated Room. It's a novel triggered by a dreadful case of abuse and exploring the bonds of motherhood and the question of how you can be a parent in an extreme environment. The critics loved her rare and quite radical use of a child narrator to explore the confines of imprisonment. And the success of Room took Emma Donoghue's literary career to a new height. Hear her talk about Room in Book Club tomorrow afternoon at 3:30.